pack of lies from the start. She was a good liar then. Or I was a middle-aged fool. He shrugs ruefully. My Sue had passed away the year before, and this girl, who could have been my daughter. Perhaps I was too trusting. That's certainly how our internal investigation saw it afterward. Officer coming up to retirement, pretty young woman, his judgment goes haywire. And there was some truth in that. Enough to make me take the retirement a bit early, when they suggested it, anyway. He takes a long mouthful of his beer. I sip my ginger ale. To me, the soft drink screams, I'm pregnant. But if he's noticed, D.I. Clark doesn't mention it. Looking back, there were things I should have spotted. She ID'd Nelson far too confidently on Viper, given she said he'd been wearing a balaclava during the assault. As for the accusation against the ex-boyfriend, he shrugs.
You don't believe that either, in hindsight?
We didn't even believe it at the time. It was just her lawyer's way of getting her off. I felt scared I can't be held responsible for what I said. It worked, too. Plus, the Crown Prosecution Service was none too keen to tell the world in open court what a fool she'd made of us. She had to accept a formal caution for wasting, but it was a slap on the wrist, nothing more.
But you still arrested Simon Wakefield after she died?
Yes. Well, that was more arse-covering, really. Suddenly there was a possibility we might have been looking at this all wrong. Young woman alleges rape, then admits lying but claims her boyfriend's a Jekyll and Hyde character who's violent toward her. Soon after, she's found dead. If it turns out he did kill her, we're stuffed. Even if it turns out to be suicide, it doesn't look like the police treated her very well, does it? Either way, it's better to be seen to have arrested someone.
So you were just going through the motions?
Oh, don't get me wrong. That might have been why the high-ups wanted the arrest, but my team did a proper job when we interviewed him. There was no evidence whatsoever to suggest Simon Wakefield had anything to do with Emma's death. His only mistake was getting involved with her in the first place, and I can hardly blame him for that. Like I said, older and wiser men than him had fallen for her charms. He frowns. I'll tell you something that was unusual, though. When most people are caught lying to the police, they cave in pretty quickly. Emma's response was to tell another lie. It might have been planted in her head by a brief, but even so, that's not a common reaction.
How do you think she died?
Two possibilities. One, she killed herself.
Out of depression?
He shakes his head. I don't think so. More likely her lies had caught up with her somehow.
And the second?
The most obvious one.
I frown. What's that?
You don't seem to have considered the possibility that it was Dion Nelson who killed her.
It's true. I've been so focused on Edward and Simon, the possibility of it being someone else altogether has hardly crossed my mind.
Nelson was, probably still is, for all I know, a vicious piece of work, he continues. He's got convictions for violence dating back to when he was 12. When Emma nearly got him convicted with a made-up story, he'd have wanted revenge.
He's silent for a moment.
Emma said as much, actually. She told us Nelson was making threats against her.
Did you investigate them?
We logged them.
Is that the same thing?
She'd been arrested for wasting police time. You think checking out every allegation she made after that was a top priority? It already looked as if we'd been far too quick to charge Nelson with rape in the first place. What with his lawyer alleging racial harassment, there was no way we were going after him again without firm evidence.
I think, Tell me about this video, the one on Emma's phone. How come you mistook it for rape when it was nothing of the sort?
Because it was brutal, he says flatly. Maybe I'm old-fashioned. I just can't see how people can enjoy that kind of thing. But if there's one thing I've learned in 25 years policing, it's that you could never understand other people's sex lives. Young people now, they see this nasty aggressive porn on the internet. They think it might be fun to make a video like that on their own phone. Men treating women as objects, women going along with it. Why? It baffles me. It really does. But in Emma's case, that's what happened. And with her boyfriend's best friend, too. Who was that? A man called Saul Axoy, who worked for the same company Emma did. Nelson's lawyer got a private investigator to track him down and persuaded him to make a statement. Of course, Axoy hadn't broken any laws, but still, what a mess.
But if it was Dion Nelson who killed her, I say, my mind still running on Clark's theory, how did he get into the house?
That I don't know.
Clark puts down his empty glass.
My bus is in 10 minutes. I should go.
1 Folgate Street has a state-of-the-art security system. That was one of the things Emma liked about it.
State-of-the-art, Clark snorts. Maybe 10 years ago. These days we don't consider anything connected to the internet high security. They're way too easy to hack.
I suddenly hear Edward's voice in my head. The shower was on when they found her. She must have been running downstairs with wet feet. And why was the shower on? I say. Clark looks confused.
Sorry?
The shower. It's operated by a bangle. I show him the one on my own wrist. It recognizes you when you get in and adjusts the water to your personal settings. Then when you get out, it switches itself off again. He shrugs.
If you say so.
What about the other data from 1 Folgate Street, the entry phone video and so on? Did you examine that? He shakes his head.
By the time she was found, 48 hours had passed. The hard drive had wiped itself clean. A lot of security systems do that to save on disk space. It's a shame, but there you are.
Something happened with the house. That's got to be part of it.
Perhaps. It's a mystery we'll never solve now, I suppose.
He stands up and reaches for his grocery bag. I stand too. I'm about to offer him my hand when he surprises me by leaning forward to kiss my cheek. His clothes smell slightly of beer.
Nice to meet you, Jane. And good luck. Frankly, I doubt you'll come across anything we didn't. But if you do, will you let me know? It still bugs me what happened to Emma.
And not many cases do that.
Then, Emma. There was a time when 1 Folgate Street seemed like a calm, serene haven. Now it doesn't. It feels claustrophobic and mean, like the house is angry with me. But of course, I'm just putting my own feelings onto these blank walls. It's people who are angry with me, not the house. That makes me think about Edward, and I start to panic about the letter I gave him. What was I thinking? I send him a text. Please don't read it. Just throw it away. With most people, that would be enough to make them read it for sure. But Edward isn't like most people. That still doesn't solve the problem that sooner or later I'm going to have to tell him about Simon and Saul and Nelson and the police. And there's no way of doing that without admitting I've been lying to him. Even just thinking about it makes me want to cry. I hear my mother's voice, that thing she always said when I was caught lying as a child. Liars shouldn't be criers. There was the rhyme she used to recite too, about a little girl called Matilda who called the fire brigade so often they didn't believe her when there really was a fire. for every time she shouted fire, they only answered little liar. And therefore when her aunt returned, Matilda and the house were burned. I got even with my mother, though. When I was 14, I stopped eating. The doctors diagnosed anorexia, but I knew I never really had an eating disorder. I was just proving that my willpower was stronger than hers. Soon, the whole household was frantically worrying about my diet, my weight, my calorie intake, whether I was having a good or bad day, whether my periods had stopped or I was feeling faint or if I had pale, furry hair sprouting on my arms and cheeks. Mealtimes dragged on forever, with my parents trying to cajole or bribe or bully me into swallowing just one more forkful. I was allowed to make up ever more outlandish diets, on the theory that if I found something I liked, I'd be more likely to eat it. For a week, we all ate nothing but slices of fried apple sprinkled on avocado soup. Another time, it was pear and watercress salad 3 times a day. My father had been a distant, detached parent before, but once I was ill, I became his number one priority. I was sent to various private clinics where they talked about low self-esteem and the need to feel successful at something. But of course, I was successful at something. Not eating. I learned to smile wearily but angelically and to say I was sure they were right and that from now on I would try, really try, to think more positive thoughts about myself. I stopped when a tough female psychologist looked me in the eye and said she knew perfectly well I was just manipulating people, and if I didn't start eating soon, it would be too late. Anorexia changes the way your brain works, apparently. You get into patterns of thought, patterns that emerge when you least expect them. Stay that way for too long and you carry those patterns for the rest of your life. Like that old wives' tale about the wind changing when you frown. I stopped being anorexic, but I did stay thin. People liked that, I discovered. Men in particular felt protective toward me. They thought I was fragile when actually I'm a person of iron determination. But sometimes, when things are getting out of hand, like they are now, I remember the lovely, satisfying feeling it gave me not to eat, knowing I was in control of my destiny after all. I managed to resist the temptation for now, but there's a sick, hollow feeling in my stomach whenever I think about what's happened. These are sworn statements from some of your colleagues. How many? Who else besides Saul? I suppose it doesn't even matter now. The news will be all around the building. And Amanda, one of my best friends, will know that her husband had sex with me. I email HR to say I'm ill. I need to stay away from work until I can figure out what to do. To keep myself busy, I give the house a much-needed clean. Not thinking, I leave the front door open while I deal with the rubbish. It's only when I hear a noise behind me that I whip around, my heart in my mouth. A tiny, skeletal face, as wide-eyed as a baby monkey, stares up at me. It's a kitten, a little Siamese. Seeing me, it sits down on the stone floor expectantly, as if to say I'm responsible for finding its owner now. "Who are you?" I ask. It only mews. Unconcerned, it allows me to pick it up. It's all skin and bones and soft, suede-like fur. The moment it's in my arms, it starts to purr noisily. "And what am I going to do with you?" I say. I go from house to house, taking the kitten with me. This is the kind of street where both partners need to work to afford the mortgage or the rent, and at most of the houses, there's no answer. But at number 3, a woman with curly red hair and freckles comes to the door, wiping floury hands on an apron. Behind her, I can see a kitchen and 2 red-haired children, a boy and a girl, also wearing aprons. "Hello," she says. Then she sees the kitten, still purring voluptuously in my arms. "Oh, aren't you sweet," she tells it. "I don't suppose you know whose it is," I ask. "It just came into my house." She shakes her head. "I haven't heard of anyone around here with a kitten. Which house are you?" "Number 1, I say, gesturing next door. The Führer's bunker? Well, I suppose someone has to live there. I'm Maggie Evans, by the way. Do you want to come in? I'll make some calls to the other mums. Already the children are clustering around, clamouring to be allowed to stroke the kitten. Their mother makes them wash their hands first. I wait while she phones some neighbours. Three builders in hard hats troop up through the kitchen from a basement, placing empty mugs politely in the sink. Welcome to the madhouse, Maggie Evans says as she comes off the phone. Although actually it doesn't seem very mad at all. Both the children and the builders are incredibly well-mannered. I'm drawing a blank, I'm afraid, she adds. Chloe, Tim, do you want to make some found kitten posters? The children enthusiastically agree. Chloe wants to know if they can keep the kitten if no one claims it. Maggie says firmly that the kitten will soon grow up into a great big cat, at which point it will eat Hector. Who Hector is, I never find out. While the children draw their posters, Maggie makes tea and asks me how long I've been at 1 Folgate Street. We weren't keen on it being built in the first place, she confides. It's just so out of keeping. And the architect was so rude. There was a planning meeting for him to listen to our concerns. He just stood there without saying a word. Then he went away and he didn't change a thing, not a single thing. I bet it's hell to live in. Actually, it's lovely, I say. I met a previous tenant who couldn't stand it. She only lasted a few weeks. She said it was like the place had turned against her. There are all these strange rules, aren't there? A few. They're quite sensible, really, I say. Well, I couldn't live there. Timmy, she calls, don't use the china plates for paint. What do you do, by the way, she says to me. I work in marketing, but I'm out sick at the moment. Oh, she goes. She looks sideways at me, puzzled. I clearly don't look very sick. Then she glances anxiously at the children. Don't worry, it's nothing catching. I lower my voice. Just a course of chemotherapy. It wipes me out, that's all. Instantly her eyes are full of concern. Oh, my dear, I'm so sorry. Don't be. I'm fine, really. Right as rain, I say bravely. By the time I leave, clutching a pile of homemade Is This Your Kitten posters, as well as the kitten itself, Maggie Evans and I are firm friends. Back in 1 Folgate Street, the kitten explores with increasing confidence, making tiger-like little leaps up the stairs to the bedroom. When I go to look for it, I find it spread out on my bed on its back, fast asleep, one paw stretched out to the air. I realize I've come to a decision about work. I get out my phone and dial the main switchboard. Flow Water Supplies, how may I help you? A voice says. Can you put me through to Helen in HR, please? There's a pause, then the head of HR comes on the line. Hello? Helen, it's Emma, I say. Emma Matthews. I need to make a formal complaint about Saul Aksoy.
Now, Jane. If tracking down D.I. Clark was straightforward, getting Saul Aksoy's email address is even easier. Typing his name and Flow Water Supplies into Google reveals he left the company 3 years ago. Now he's the founder and CEO of Volcano, a new brand of mineral water sourced, so a slick website informs me, from underneath a dormant volcano in Fiji. A picture shows a good-looking, dark-skinned man with a shaved head, very white teeth, and a diamond stud in one ear. I sent him my by-now standard email. Dear Saul, I hope you don't mind me writing to you out of the blue like this. I'm doing some research about a former tenant of the house I live in, 1 Folgate Street. We're all connected now, I think, as I send it off into cyberspace. Everyone and everything. But for the first time since I started this, I get knocked back. The answer comes back swiftly, but it's a no. Thank you for your email. I don't discuss Emma Matthews, not with anyone. Saul. I try again. I'm actually going to be near your office tomorrow evening. Maybe we could have a quick drink? I attach my messenger details. From the little I know about Saul Axoy, I can be reasonably sure he'll check me out on Facebook. And perhaps, immodestly, I'm guessing he wouldn't mind having a drink with me. This time, the answer's more positive.
Okay, I can spare you half an hour. I'll meet you at the Zebra Bar in Dutton Street at 8.
I get there early and order a lime and soda. My breasts are bigger now, and I'm needing to pee more often. Otherwise, you'd barely suspect I was pregnant. Although Mia claims I'm looking unusually well. Glowing, she says. It doesn't feel like that when I'm throwing up in the mornings. My first impression of Saul Axoy is jewelry. In addition to the ear stud, he wears a thin gold chain tucked into the V of his open-collared shirt. Cufflinks are visible under the sleeves of his suit, and there's a signet ring on his right hand, as well as an expensive-looking watch on his left. He seems upset that I already have a drink, particularly a soft one, and tries hard to press a glass of champagne on me before giving up and ordering one for himself. Saul is as different from Simon Wakefield as it's possible to get, I find myself thinking. And Edward Monkford is utterly different from both of them. It seems incredible that Emma could have had relationships with all three men, where Simon's eager to please, but also touchy and insecure, and Edward's calm and super confident. Saul is pushy and brash and loud. He also has a habit of saying, "Yeah?" aggressively at the end of his sentences, as if trying to force me to agree with him. "Thank you for meeting me," I say after some preliminary chat. I know it must look odd, given that I didn't even know Emma, but it seems to me that almost no one really knew her. Everyone I speak to has a different version of what she was like. He shrugs.
"I didn't really meet you for that, yeah? I still can't stand to talk about her."
"Why's that?"
"Because she was a bunny boiler," he says bluntly, "and she cost me my job. Not that I missed the job, it was shit. But she lied about me, and I don't take that from anyone."
"What did she do?"
"Complained to HR that I got her drunk and pressured her into sex. Said, amongst other things, that I'd offered to help her move into marketing if she'd sleep with me. She claimed she'd said no, and I couldn't handle the rejection. As it happens, I did have a word with the marketing director, tried to do her a favour, but that was before we slept together, not after. But she made this allegation before it all came out she'd been busted for crying rape, yeah? And it just so happened there were a few girls in that company who were a bit upset when they found out about each other. Plus my wife, my now ex-wife, looking to stitch me up, so I was screwed. Best thing that ever happened to me, as it turned out, but she couldn't have known that at the time."
"So you and Emma had, what, a fling? An affair?" There's a bowl of salted nuts on the bar, and I'm finding it hard not to eat them all while he's talking. I push them away. "We had sex a couple of times, that's all. A training away day with an overnight in a hotel. Things got out of hand on the free booze." He grimaces.
"Look, I'm not proud of it. Simon's my friend, or at least he was before all this. But I've never been good at saying no, and it was her who kept coming on to me, believe me. In fact, she wanted to go on with it even when I decided we'd had our fun and it was time to finish. I reckon the risk was a big part of it for her. She definitely liked the fact that we were doing it behind Simon's back. Amanda's too, for that matter. If you ask me, I ended up doing Simon a favour, although he never saw it that way."
"Are you and Simon still in touch?"
He shakes his head. "We haven't spoken in years."
"I have to ask you this. Someone who looked at the video on Emma's phone told me it was quite rough." He doesn't look embarrassed.
Yeah. Well, she liked all that, didn't she? Most women do when it comes down to it.
He gives me a direct look. And I like a woman who knows what she wants. I feel my skin crawl, although I try not to show it. But why make a video at all?
Just fooling around. Everyone's done it, yeah?
She told me later she'd deleted it, but she must have kept it. That was Emma. She'd have enjoyed knowing she had something like that. Something that could blow her whole fucking life and mine apart if it came out. Her little bit of power. I probably should have double-checked, but by then I'd moved on.
Did you ever notice her lying about other things? That seems to be something else people say about her, that she didn't always tell the truth.
Who does, yeah?
He leans back, more relaxed now.
Though I did notice she'd say these stupid things sometimes. Like, Simon told me she'd almost been a model. Some top agency had been desperate to sign her, but she'd decided modelling wasn't for her. Yeah, right. She was saving herself for a career as a PA in a water supplies company instead. Anyway, she told me a local photographer had approached her once in the street, but he seemed a bit pervy, so she hadn't done anything about it. And it got me thinking, which version was the real one? Like, sometimes she just exaggerated a little bit for effect, and sometimes she went all the way and created this whole fantasy world for herself.
Mind you, he adds, to hear me talk to retailers, you'd probably think I've already got £1 million turnover. Fake it till you make it, right? He finishes his champagne.
Hey, let's not talk about her anymore. Let's get a bottle and talk about you.
Has anyone told you you've got really beautiful eyes?
Thank you, I say, already sliding off my stool. I've got to be somewhere else, but I do appreciate you meeting me.
What?
He pretends to be shocked.
Going already? Who are you meeting? Is it your boyfriend? We've only just started. Come on, sit down. We'll get cocktails, yeah?
No, really.
It's the least you can do. I've made time for you. You owe me now. Let's have a proper drink.
He's smiling, but there's a hardness and a desperation behind the eyes. An aging Lothario trying to bolster his fading self-esteem with sexual conquests.
No, really, I repeat firmly. As I leave the bar, he's already scanning the room, looking for someone else to hit on.
Then, Emma. They say with alcoholics there's a moment where you finally hit rock bottom. Nobody can tell you when it's time to quit. Nobody can persuade you. You have to get to that place by yourself and recognize it for what it is, and then, only then, do you have a chance of turning things around. I've reached that place. Blaming Saul was at best a stopgap. There's no doubt he deserves it. He's been leching after girls in the office behind Amanda's back for ages. Everyone knows what kind of person he is, and it's time someone stopped him. But on the other hand, I have to face up to the fact that I let him get me drunk. I let him do what he did. After Simon's neediness and his constant, annoying adoration, it was actually refreshing just to be wanted for selfish, uncomplicated sex. But that doesn't change the fact that what I did was stupid. I have to change. I have to start being someone who sees things clearly, not a victim. Carol once told me that most people put all their energies into trying to change other people, when the only person you can really change is yourself, and even that's incredibly difficult. I see what she means now. I think I'm ready to be someone different from the person who let all this shit happen to her. I look for the card with Carol's number on it, meaning to call her, but I can't find it. It beats me how anything can go missing in one Folgate Street, but it seems to happen all the time. Everything from laundry to a bottle of perfume I could have sworn was in the bathroom. I no longer have the energy to track them down. The kitten, though, I can't ignore. Despite the children's posters, there haven't been any calls about him. I've established he's a boy now, while for his part he wanders around 1 Folgate Street as if he owns the place. He needs a name. Of course, I think of calling him Cat, after the stray in Breakfast at Tiffany's, but then I have a better idea. I'm like Cat here, a no-name slob. We belong to nobody, and nobody belongs to us. Slob it is. I go down to the corner shop and buy him some cat food and other supplies. When I get back, there's someone outside the house, a kid on a bike. For a moment, I think he must be here about Slob. Then I realize it's the same kid who swore at me after the bail hearing. He grins and unhooks a bucket from his handlebars. No, not a bucket. A tin of paint, already open. He plants both feet on the ground, straddling the bike, and hurls the contents straight at the house, at the pristine pale stone, just missing me. A red gouge, like a giant bleeding gash, appears across 1 Folgate Street's front. The tin clatters to the ground and rolls away, still spiraling red. "Know where you live now, bitch," he shouts in my face as he pedals off. My hands are shaking as I get out my phone and find the number D.I. Clark gave me. "It's me, Emma," I gabble. "You said to call if it happened again, and it has. He just threw paint all over the front of the house." "Emma Matthews," he says. It's almost like he's repeating my name for the benefit of other people in the room. "Why are you calling this number?" "You gave it to me, remember? You said to phone if there was any more intimidation." "This is my personal phone. If you want to report something, you should call the front desk. I'll give you the number. Do you have a pen?" "You said you'd protect me," I say slowly. "The circumstances have changed, obviously. I'll text you the right number to call," he says. The line goes dead. "Bastard," I hiss. I'm sobbing again, tears of impotence and shame. I go and stare at the huge red smear. I have absolutely no idea how to get it cleaned off. I know it means I am going to have to speak to Edward now.
10. A new friend confides she was once sent to prison for shoplifting. It was some time ago, and she has turned her life around since. Do you consider it irrelevant? Everyone deserves a second chance. Appreciate her honesty in sharing this with you. Reciprocate by confiding a mistake of your own. Feel sorry for her that she was ever in that situation. Or decide she's not really the kind of person you want as a friend.
Now, Jane. I come back from my meeting with Saul Axoy by tube, wishing I could afford a taxi. The grime, the overcrowding, and the end-of-day smell of damp and dirty bodies are all getting increasingly hard to take. No one offers me a seat, not that I'd really expect them to yet, but a woman with an 8-month-sized bump and a baby on board pin gets on at King's Cross and somebody stands up for her. She sinks into the seat with an audible gasp. In a few months' time, I think, that'll be me. 1 Folgate Street, though, is my haven, my cocoon. One reason I'm putting off telling Edward about this pregnancy, I've realized, is because a part of me is frightened Mia's right and he'll simply throw me out. I tell myself he'll be different when it's his own child, that our relationship is stronger than his precious rules, that he'll be fine with baby monitors and buggies and nursery freezers and playmats and all the other messy paraphernalia of parenthood. I've even been checking developmental milestones online. Given his parents' type A, disciplined personalities, our child could be sleeping through the night at 3 months, walking within a year, toilet trained by 18 months. Surely it's not so very long to put up with a little chaos. But somehow, I haven't been so confident that I actually call him. And, of course, however serene my surroundings, there are still my own terrors to be faced. Isabel was born silent and still. This baby, pray God, will be different. Over and over I imagine that moment, the waiting, the first snatch of breath, that exultant, mewling cry. What will I feel? Triumph? Or something more complicated? Sometimes I actually find myself apologizing to Isabel in my head. I promise I won't forget you. I promise no one can take your place. You'll always be my firstborn, my beloved, my precious girl. I will always grieve for you. But now there will be another to love. And can there really be such an inexhaustible store of love in me that my feelings for Isabel remain undimmed? I try to focus on the immediate issue. Edward. The more I tell myself I have to speak to him, the more a little voice reminds me that I don't really know this man, the father of my child, at all. All I know is that he's remarkable, which is another way of saying he's unusual and obsessive. I still don't even know what really happened between him and Emma. What responsibility, moral or otherwise, he might bear for her death. Or whether both Simon and Carol, in their different ways, are wrong about that. I am as methodical and efficient as ever. I buy 3 packets of fluorescent post-it notes in different colours and turn one of the refectory walls into a giant mind map. On one side, I stick a post-it labelled accident. Then in a row, suicide. Murdered, Simon Wakefield. Murdered, Dion Nelson. And murdered, person unknown. Finally, and somewhat reluctantly, I add a post-it labelled murdered, Edward Monkford. Underneath each one, I put more post-its for the evidence that supports it. Where I have no proof, I put question marks. There are only a couple of notes I'm pleased to see underneath Edward's name. Simon, too, has fewer than the others, although following my conversation with Saul, I have to add one that says, revenge for sex with best friend. After some thought, I add another to the row. Murdered, D.I. Clark. Because even the policeman had a motive. Being made a fool of by Emma had effectively cost him his job. Of course, I don't actually believe he did it, any more than I think Edward did. But he'd clearly been a little bit smitten with Emma, and I don't want to rule out any possibilities prematurely. Thinking about D.I. Clark, I realize I forgot to ask him if the police knew about Edward's stalker, Jorgen something. I add another post-it. Murdered. Edward's stalker. 8 possibilities in all. As I stare at the wall, it dawns on me that I've gotten precisely nowhere. As D.I. Clark said, it's one thing to theorize, quite another to find proof. All I have here is a list of suppositions. No wonder the coroner reached an open verdict. The bright colours of the post-its are like a jangling piece of modern art on 1 Folgate Street's pristine stone. Sighing, I take them down and drop them in the garbage. The recycling's full now, so I carry it outside. 1 Folgate Street's large recycle bins are down the side of the house, next to the boundary with number 3. As I tip everything in, it all comes out in reverse order, the most recent first, and then the older stuff. I see yesterday's food packaging, a copy of last weekend's Sunday Times magazine, an empty shampoo container from the week before, and a drawing. I fish it out. It's the sketch Edward did of me before he went away, the one he said was fine but didn't want to keep. It's as if he's drawn me not once, but twice. In the main drawing, I have my head turned to the right. It's so detailed you can see the tautness of my neck muscles and the arch of my clavicle. but underneath, or over that, there's a second drawing. Barely more than a few jagged, suggestive lines done with a surprising energy and violence. My head turned the other way, my mouth open in a kind of snarl. The two heads pointing in opposite directions give the drawing a disturbing sense of movement. Which one's the pentimento and which the finished thing? And why did Edward say there was nothing wrong with it? Did he not want me to see this double image for some reason? Hello there! I jump. A woman of about 40 with red curly hair is standing just across the boundary with number 3, emptying her own rubbish. Sorry, you startled me, I say. Hello. She gestures at 1 Folgate Street. You're the latest tenant, are you? I'm Maggie. I shake her hand over the fence. Jane Cavendish. Actually, she confides, you gave me a bit of a shock too. At first I thought you were the other girl. Poor thing. I feel my spine tingle. You knew Emma? To talk to, nothing more. She was lovely, though. So sweet. She came around once with a stray kitten she'd found, and we got to chatting. When was this? Maggie makes a face. Just a few weeks before she... You know. Maggie Evans. I remember now. She was quoted in the local paper after Emma died, saying how much the neighbours hated 1 Folgate Street. I felt so sorry for her, Maggie's saying. She mentioned she was off because of cancer treatment. When they found her, I wondered if that was something to do with it, if the chemotherapy hadn't worked and perhaps she'd taken her own life. Obviously, she told me in confidence, but I felt I had a duty to mention it to the police. But then they said there'd been a full post-mortem and she didn't have cancer. I remember thinking how awful to have beaten such a terrible illness and still die like that. Yes, I say, but I'm thinking, cancer? I'm fairly sure it must be yet another lie. But why? Mind you, she adds, I told her to keep that kitten well hidden from the landlord. Anyone who can build a house like that? She tries to leave the words hanging, but anything more than a few moments' silence is beyond her, and pretty soon she's back on her favourite topic, 1 Folgate Street. Despite what she says, she clearly relishes living next to a building of such notoriety. Well, must get on, she says at last. Gotta get the kids' teas. I wonder how I'm going to cope with that side of being a mum. Putting my own life on hold to make kids tease and gossip with neighbours. There are worse things, I suppose. I look down at the drawing in my hand. Another reference from art history days springs into my head. Janus, the two-headed god, god of deception. Is the second image even me? Or is it, I suddenly think, Emma Matthews? I wait until Maggie's gone and then, discreetly, fish down through the layers of the recycling until I find the post-its again. They're all stuck together now, a millefeuille of bright green and red and yellow sheets. I take them back into the house. I'm not done with them, after all.
Then, Emma. I put off going into work for as long as I can, but by Friday I know I need to get it over with. I leave Slob some cat food and a tray of litter and go. At the office, I feel eyes following me as I make my way to my desk. The only person who speaks to me is Brian. Oh, Emma, he goes. Feeling better? That's good. You can join us for the monthly catch-up at 10. From his manner, I gather no one's told him, but the women are another matter. No one meets my gaze. Heads lower toward computer screens whenever I look around. Then I see Amanda striding toward me. Quickly I get up and head for the loos. I know there's going to be a confrontation, but it's better we do it somewhere private than out here with everyone gawking. I just make it. The door hasn't even shut behind me before she's banged it open so hard it bounces off the little rubber stopper. "What the fuck?" she shouts. "Amanda," I go, "wait." "Don't fucking give me that," she yells. "Don't tell me you're sorry or any of that bullshit. You were my friend and you screwed my husband. You even kept a video of you giving him a blowjob on your phone. And now you have the fucking nerve to make a complaint about him. You evil, lying bitch." She's waving her hands in my face, and for a moment I think she's going to hit me. "And Simon," she continues, "you lied to him. You lied to me. You lied to the police." "I didn't lie about Saul," I say. "Oh, I know he's no angel, but when women like you throw yourselves at him..." "It was Saul who raped me," I say. That stops her. "What?" she goes. "This is going to sound really weird," I say urgently, "but I promise you this time it's the truth. And I know I'm partly to blame. Saul got me drunk, so drunk I could hardly stand. I shouldn't have let him do that. I knew why he was doing it, but I didn't realize how far he was going to take it. I think he may even have spiked my drink. Then he said he'd walk me to my room. Next thing I knew, he was forcing himself on me. I tried to say no, but he wouldn't listen." She stares at me. "You're lying," she says. "I'm not. I have told lies, I admit that, but I swear I'm not lying about this." "He wouldn't do that," she says. "He's been unfaithful, but there's no way he's a rapist." But she doesn't sound quite so certain anymore. "He didn't even seem to think it was rape," I say. "Afterward, he kept telling me how great it had been. And I was so confused. I wondered if I was somehow remembering it all wrong. But then he sent me the video. I hadn't even realized he was recording it, that's how out of it I was. He said how much he'd been enjoying watching it back. It was like a reminder that he could tell Simon anytime he liked. I didn't know what to do, I panicked." "Why didn't you tell anyone?" she says suspiciously. "Who could I tell? You seemed so happy then, I didn't want to be the one to break up your marriage. And you know how Simon's in awe of Saul. I wasn't sure he'd believe me, let alone whether he'd be able to handle knowing his best friend had done that to me." "But you kept the video. Why would you do that?" "As evidence," I say. "I was trying to work up the courage to go to the police, or to HR at least. But the longer I left it, the harder it got. When I looked at the video, even I could see it was ambiguous, and I was ashamed to let anyone see it. I thought maybe it was all my fault. And then the police found it on my phone and assumed in front of Simon that it was Dion Nelson, and everything just got so complicated." "Jesus," she says disbelievingly. "Jesus, you're making this up, Emma." "I'm not, I swear I'm not." I add, "Saul's a bastard, Amanda. I think deep down you know that. You know there've been other girls. Girls in the office, girls in clubs, anyone he can get his hands on. If you back me up, he'll get what he deserves. Maybe not all of it, but at least he'll lose his job." "What about the police?" she says, and I know she's starting to believe me. "The police won't get involved unless there's concrete evidence of a crime. This is just about him losing his job, not going to prison. After what he did to you, don't you think that's only fair?" At last, she nods. "There are at least two girls in this company I know he's slept with," she says. "Michelle in accounts and Leona in marketing. I'll give HR their names." "Thank you," I say. "Have you told Simon any of this?" I shake my head. "You ought to." At the thought of Simon, kind, adoring, trusting Simon, something strange happens. I no longer feel quite so contemptuous of him. I used to hate him for being Saul's friend, for going on and on about what a great guy Sawley was, when all the time Sawley was actually just a selfish, aggressive prick. But now I don't. Now there's a part of me that remembers how nice it felt to be forgiven. To my surprise, I find I'm crying. I swipe the tears away with a paper towel from the dispenser. I can't go back, I say. Simon's over. When something's gone that wrong, you can't ever put it right.
Now, Jane. Just some gel that may feel a bit cold, the sonographer says kindly. I hear the ketchup squelch of KY jelly, then the gel gets smeared around my stomach by the probe. The feeling takes me back to Isabel's first scan, the stickiness on my skin that lasted all day like a hidden secret beneath my clothes. The curl of printer paper in my bag that showed the ghostly, fern-like curve of a fetus. I take a deep breath, ambushed by a sudden surge of emotion. Relax, the sonographer murmurs, misunderstanding. She presses the probe hard against my midriff, angling it this way and that. There. I look up at the monitor. An outline emerges from the murk, and I gasp out loud. She smiles at my reaction. How many children do you have? She says conversationally. I must take a bit longer than most people to work out the proper answer to that, because she glances down at my notes. I'm sorry, she adds quietly. I see you had a stillbirth. I nod. There doesn't seem to be anything else to say. Do you want to know the baby's sex? She adds. Yes, please. You're having a little boy. You're having a little boy. Just the simple confidence of that statement, the expectation that everything will be all right this time, overwhelms me with emotion, joy, and grief, colliding so that I burst into tears of both. Here, have one of these. She hands me the box of tissues they use for wiping off the jelly. I snuffle into one while she gets on with her work. After a few minutes, she says, I'm just going to ask the doctor to pop in. Why? Is something wrong? I'd just like him to talk you through the results, she says reassuringly. Then she's gone. I'm not overly concerned. This is happening because I'm technically a high-risk patient. Given that Isabel's problems only started in the last week of pregnancy, there's no reason to think anything will be wrong now. It seems an age before the door opens and Dr. Gifford's face comes into view.
Hello, Jane.
Hello. I greet him like an old friend now.
Jane, I just want to explain one of the main reasons we do this scan at around 12 weeks. It's so we can get a heads up on some of the more common fetal abnormalities.
Oh no, I think. It can't be.
The scan doesn't give us an exact indication, but it does highlight where there may be an increased risk. In your case, we're obviously looking for any problems with the placenta or umbilical cord, and I'm pleased to report that both of those seem to be working normally.
I seize on the words, thank God, thank God.
But we also measure what's called the nuchal translucency. That's the thickness of the fluid at the back of the baby's neck. In your case, the NT does indicate a slightly increased risk of Down syndrome. We class anything above a 1 in 150 probability high risk. For you, it's currently about 1 in 100. That means for every 100 mothers with this risk profile, one will give birth to a baby with Down syndrome. Do you understand?
Yes. I say, and I do. That is, I can follow what he's saying with my brain. I'm good with numbers. It's what I feel that I'm struggling to process. so many emotions, so overwhelming that they almost cancel one another out, leaving me clear-headed but numb. All my plans, my carefully laid plans, have fallen apart.
The only way to know for certain is to do a test that involves putting a needle into your womb and drawing out some fluid, Dr. Gifford saying. Unfortunately, that test itself carries a small risk of triggering a miscarriage.
How small?
About 1 in 100.
He smiles apologetically, as if to say he knows I'm bright enough to understand the irony of this. My risk of miscarriage with the test is exactly the same as the risk of my baby having Down syndrome without it.
There is a new, non-invasive test that can give a reasonably accurate result, he adds. It measures tiny fragments of the baby's DNA in your blood. Unfortunately, it isn't currently available from this NHS trust.
I grasp at what he's saying. You mean I can have it done privately?
He nods. It costs around £400.
I want it, I say quickly. I'll find a way to pay for it somehow.
I'll make a referral for you now, and we can give you some leaflets to read. These days, many children with Down syndrome live long and relatively normal lives. But there are no guarantees. It's a decision every parent has to make for themselves.
By decision, I realize he means whether or not to have an abortion. I'm still numb as I leave the hospital. I'm going to have a baby. A little boy. Another chance at motherhood. Or not. Could I really cope with a disabled child? Because I'm under no illusions that that's what a child with Down syndrome is. Yes, their prospects may be better than they once were, but these are children who still need more parenting, more help, more dedication, more love and support. I've seen mothers with disabled children in the street, endlessly patient, clearly exhausted, and thought to myself how amazing they are. Am I really one of them? It's only when I get back to 1 Folgate Street that I realize I really can't put off talking to Edward any longer now. It's one thing to pick my moment to tell him about being a father, quite another to conceal something like this. All the leaflets emphasize the importance of discussing the situation with your partner. The first thing I do, though, inevitably, is a search on the internet for Down syndrome. Within minutes, I feel sick. Trisomy 21, as Down syndrome is properly known, is associated with thyroid problems, sleep disorders, gastrointestinal complications, vision problems, heart defects, spinal and hip instability, low muscle tone, and learning difficulties. What safety precautions can you take to reduce wandering? Install good locks on all internal doors, put stop signs on outside doors, and think about fencing your yard completely. Potty training a child with low muscle tone is certainly extra challenging. We've had 3 years of accidents, but I'm glad to say we're getting there. We ate yogurt in front of a mirror so our daughter could see why she was spilling it. That worked a treat. Hand-eye coordination remains a challenge. Then, even more guiltily, I Google Down syndrome plus abortion. Of those couples who receive an antenatal diagnosis of Down syndrome in the UK, 92% choose abortion. Under the Abortion Act, termination of a baby with Down syndrome is legal right up to the point of delivery. We realized it was better for my partner and I to suffer the guilt and grief of an abortion than to let our daughter suffer all her life. Oh God. Oh God. Oh God. Isabel would be sleeping through the night by now. Isabel would be sitting up, grasping things, putting them in her mouth. She'd be crawling, perhaps even walking. She'd be clever and athletic and high-achieving, just like her mother. instead of which I have to decide whether or not to saddle myself with... I stop. That's not the right way to think about this. Dr. Gifford has made an appointment for me at the testing center first thing tomorrow. They'll give me the results by phone within a couple of days, he promised. In the meantime, I must try not to let it hang over me. After all, the odds are still vastly in favor of everything being fine. Thousands of expectant mothers have a scare like this, only to discover that's all it ever was. A scare. I phone Mia and cry over her for what seems like hours.
Then, Emma. I sit on the train wondering what I'm going to say to him. Power stations and fields flicker by. Commuter towns and rural stops come and go. Every speech I prepare in my head sounds wrong, and I know the more I rehearse it, the more fake it'll get. Better to speak from the heart and hope he listens. I don't text him until I'm off the train and waiting for a taxi. Coming to see you. We have to talk. The taxi driver refuses to believe my destination even exists. There's nothing there, love. The nearest house would be in Tregerry, 5 miles away, until we turn down a farm track to discover an encampment of prefab work cabins and chemical toilets surrounded by mud. All around us are open fields and woods, but across the valley, trucks pass on a distant road, and I can see how this might indeed be a whole new town one day. Edward strides from a cabin, his face dark with concern. Emma, he says, what's wrong? Why are you here? I take a deep breath. There's something I need to explain, I say. It's really complicated. I had to tell you in person. The cabins are full of surveyors and draftsmen, so we walk beside the woods. I tell him what I told Amanda, that I was drugged and forced into sex by one of Simon's friends, that he sent me a video he'd made of it as a way of threatening me, and the police assumed it was Dion Nelson, that I've had to accept a formal caution for wasting police time, but really none of it was my fault. He listens carefully, his expression giving nothing away. And then he tells me, very calmly, that it's over between us. No matter whether I'm telling him the truth now or not, I've lied to him in the past. He reminds me we agreed this would only continue for as long as it was perfect. He says a relationship like this is like a building, that you have to get the foundations right or the whole thing falls apart. He thought our relationship was built on honesty, when actually it was built on deceit. He says that all this, he gestures at the fields, only came about because I told him I was attacked by Dion Nelson in my own home. He says this town is now being built on a lie as well. He'd been trying to design a community in which people looked out for and respected and helped one another. But such a community can only function on trust, and now it's tainted for him. He says goodbye, his voice empty of emotion. But I know he loves me. I know he needs our games, that they answer some deep-seated hunger in him. I was wrong, I say desperately. But think what you did. How much worse was that? He frowns. What do you mean? You killed your wife, I say, and your son. You killed them because you didn't want to compromise your building. He stares at me. He denies it. I spoke to Tom Ellis, I insist. He makes a dismissive gesture. The man's a bitter, jealous failure. But don't you see, I say, I don't care. I don't care what you've done or how bad you are. Edward, we belong together. We both know it. Now I know your worst secrets and you know mine. Isn't that what you've always wanted? For us to be completely honest with each other? I sense he's torn, that he's weighing the decision in his mind, that he doesn't want to lose what we have. You're quite insane, Emma, he says at last. You're fantasizing. None of that happened. You should go back to London now.
Now, Jane. There are several reasons why I go back to see Carol Jansen again. First, I tell her, you and Simon are the only people Emma seems to have shared her fears of Edward Monkford with. That on at least one occasion, she effectively told lies to you, her own therapist. Second, you're the only person she spoke to who has a psychological background. I'm hoping you might be able to shed some light on her personality. I don't tell her the third reason yet. She frowns. What lies? I tell her what I've learned, about Saul and how Emma gave him oral sex after getting drunk. If you accept that she lied about being raped by Dion Nelson, I say, do you agree she might have lied about Edward too? She considers for a moment. People do lie to their therapists sometimes. Whether because they're in denial or from simple embarrassment, it happens. But if what you're saying is correct, Emma didn't just tell one lie. She constructed an entire fantasy world, an alternative reality. Meaning what? Well, it's not strictly my area, but the clinical term for that kind of pathological lying is pseudologia fantastica. It's associated with low self-esteem, attention-seeking, and a deep-seated desire to present yourself in a more favorable light. Being raped is hardly